Some storage space available on site that the court will be making use of. If there are people with large amounts of stuff and a limited ability or a limited desire to drag it back and forth, then I think for a very reasonable rental we can come to for you. Ms. Longby, thank you.
Thank you, sir. I do have a remaining point on policy 2. Capital B, D, subroman unit 2. So, if we look at the remaining three bullet points, if you can look at Ms. Miles' version, please. Now, the post-conferencing version with regards to the appropriate length of time action that the ECP talks about, what's reasonably practicable to implement, and the costs of the actions and mitigations. And I asked Mr. Trevelco about whether he would be, or the council would be, requiring farmer balance sheets for that, because you can anticipate, can't you, a case-by-case argument where farmers say, I can't afford that. And so Ms. Ma is recommending that be amended somewhat to say the appropriate length of time to spread the costs of actions and mitigations relative to the scale of the farming business. So larger farming businesses may need to do things sooner, and it just provides a little bit more certainty as to that particular criterion. Do you have an issue with that at all?
No.
Thank you very much. So, turn now to this. You'll be relieved I'm not going to ask you many questions about the nitrogen risk scorecard and overseer. But the high leaches will need to reduce to moderate and low, as we've just talked about. And various iterations of the planning documents use various measures to say what is moderate or low. And the beef and lamb version uses the nitrogen risk scorecard measure.
For dairy.
Have you considered whether more would be achieved for the environment if that measure is overseer, because overseer takes into account biophysical factors, whereas with the NRIS scorecard you would anticipate that those on the poorer soils or the high rainfall areas would seek to just use the scorecard approach?
I think there's two aspects to it, and because it's being employed as a drafting gate, then gets you into the scenario where the actual effects get managed through the FEP. So I think that is where that's the engine room of it, where the actual work is done by drafting gate itself. And I was intrigued by Mr. Willis's response to the question about the priorities of privacy with the advocacy. He talked about the difference in how error is assimilated in a catch of wide memory, even as a large number of which just look at the farm. So there might all the error might be focused on that farm. And I genuinely don't know what the difference is in accuracy between
All right, and you are involved in the Horizons 1 plan process, aren't you, where the in-risk scorecard has been developed to a further iteration for including biophysical factors?
Yes, I think the correct way to characterise it there is that Horizons and Advisors have recommended an adaptation of the nitrogen risk scorecard, bringing out the key drivers of risk for that. With the target catchments in the region, and they have overlain that over a biophysical profile. So it's not the case that they have included it in the scorecard, they have overlain it over the profile of the biophysical risk underlying the risk.
Yes, and you heard Dr. Crystal's evidence yesterday that if you're going to use Overseer anywhere, the YCAT would be a good place to use it.
Yes, that's my understanding. This is developed.
I'd like to turn to setbacks. We can turn to paragraph 194 of your evidence, please. And there you say that the evidence of Mr. McGibbon for Federated Farmers highlights issues of practicality in relation to fencing of water bodies, the sinuous nature of water bodies and the difficulty and cost of installing bends or corners and fences and the need to adopt straight lines to keep wires taut. Condition 2 does not adequately consider or account for this difficulty, and the answer does not lie in simply setting aside a wider setback overall, because this would result in an inefficient use of agricultural land. Now, I'm going to suggest that that issue, and we've also had the issue of obstacles in the way, should in fact be dealt with by going wider. You've noted there the inefficient use of agricultural land, but the water quality evidence is that after 5 metre setback you get diminishing returns, and that the first 5 metres does the main work in terms of particularly fire and sediment removal, and you would be familiar with the graph that's in the JWS freshwater at 401.0024. It's question 37. It's not, there are no page numbers except for the bundled page numbers, so it's 401.0024. And is it your understanding that the targets in relation to clarity in this plan are relatively ambitious?
I don't have a view on it.
Have you read the evidence of Dr. Daniel for Fish and Game? So that evidence refers to a publication, Pringram et al., which did a study on the range of ecological stressors and ranked in terms of influence on invertebrate and fish communities, which is an accepted measure of ecosystem health, and found that the top four drivers of the 12 assessed were 1, sediment management, identified as the most significant, and this was a Waikato study, 2, riparian margin management, 3, in-stream habitat management, and 4, nutrient management, nitrogen and phosphorus. And Dr. Daniel's evidence and Ms. McArthur's evidence is that riparian setbacks address all those four. But particularly with the sediment issue, 1 metre and indeed 3 metres is going to raise a lot of uncertainty, isn't it, about whether the targets are going to be achieved, particularly as they relate to the first and second order streams. And the averaging is going to be quite difficult to administer, isn't it? Because it's almost going to require a survey.
Well, I think the evidence about that, and I don't see it as any more difficult than actually enforcing an absolute requirement of 3 metres, because that would require measurement at of that at every point. So one way of measuring an average would be helpful if that was data somewhere, and it depends what level of accuracy one wants to achieve. So if you said it had to be measured at spaces of whatever, 5 meters, 10 meters, depending on the accuracy you want. And that would mean you'd be required to measure a distance over a certain length, and you'd be able to average, get the median or the average of what those setbacks were. So I don't think it is impossible, and I don't know that it would require survey by reason only of the average. In fact, I think it is achievable on the ground.
Okay, thank you. With regards to the exceptions to setbacks, and I know you have a slightly different position to the Joint Farming Party's position, but the orthodox approach to that, isn't it, rather than having a term such as it's not practicable, is to, if you can't meet it, you apply for a consent. That's the orthodox planning approach, isn't it?
Well, that's one approach, I think. Thinking about the purpose and the basis of how is the regional council going to keep people loaded in the best way possible. And the evidence I've heard is that inability to comply with some of these requirements, these might, and the differences between the 3 and the 1 week might be quite, it might result in, I don't know why, but quite marginal differences in actual water quality improvement. So if that's triggering a number of applications or resources to consent, I see that as something that is holding up getting on with the actual work of fencing, providing setbacks, creating costs and delay. And I'm really I'm struggling to see that through those consenting processes there would be any result other than some argy-bargy about exactly how far it can set back in some circumstances. And I think about whose advice would be relied on for that, and I think that would be the advice of the council certified farm plan person. And I can see a way of that to be incorporated in a more efficient way through the rules. So that's the essence of mine.
Thank you. This is incredibly important though, isn't it? Because if we don't get the expenses in the right place in the first place, we can't anticipate that they will be moved later.
That's right, and that's another element of the schedule C setback requirement, that storms come, they change the relative distance between fences, setback fences and banks, so that the requirement should be on the day they're installed,
yes,
so that people don't need to come back around. But I mean, these provisions articulate a minimum, and it's not my expectation that that would be applied in every case anyway, because of the circumstances of the land. It might be more appropriate to be a lot wider than 3 metres in some circumstances, but it states the minimum.
Because the wider setbacks have economic benefit too, in terms of they don't get taken out in floods.
I wouldn't go as far as saying that, but different intensities of the flood will have different effects. But it's really just that I expect fencing contractors will go for the straightest line between 2 points, and sometimes that'll be wider than 3 metres.
Right. Thank you. Now, to turn to the controlled activity status that you've proposed for moderate intensity dry stock farming in the Whangamurino catchment. Are you the only planner that's proposed that?
Yes, I'm on my own on that.
Right. You would have read Ms. Maher's rebuttal evidence on that?
Yes.
And so Ms. Maher's rebuttal evidence considers that even dry stock farming can increase intensity because it can include cropping and dairy support. which could occur over a larger area of the farm, and that the ability to define consent gives more ability to look at the effects on an individual case of these farming activities. Because it's not just nitrogen we're looking at with the whangamurino, it's also phosphorus and sediment, and you'd be aware of that from the evidence of Dr. Robertson and Mr. Clee.
Which are the awful contaminants for farm situations?
Yes, and with the whangamurino, which has the Restia bog system, there's evidence that there is vegetation change occurring through to now in that bog system, and we're losing the vegetation, and it's changing to a more vegetation that does not rely on the mineralised bog. So it's the sensitive system. Don't you agree that an ability to decline consent would enable an appropriate degree of scrutiny for even the farmer that you've set out in your controlled activity role?
Well, I thought that it was a sensitive and degraded system, and what has happened needs to be changed. So what I have looked at is whether you could achieve that, what is the most efficient way you could achieve that change? And I looked at the policy framework and policy and I think that in principle the approach is settled between the parties that the policy direction is to reduce diffuse and poisonous discharges, and it sits under all five objectives, but it's a particular objective for farming. And it's but the direction is to reduce, it's not to avoid, and the way that I tried to craft the controlled activity reserve matters and the position of the same minimum standards is to include particular sensitivities of this. So the question for me was, could you achieve the same reductions? And I'm here, I draw on 40 years of working with white authorities and applicants in reviewing consent schemes and local authorities to think about how it play out practically as a restricted discretionary activity. Is the discretion restricted to essentially the same matters as I'm proposing? Could I genuinely foresee a situation where the council would end up turning something down, or would it be a negotiation, effectively, as happens, about just where, how much we reduce? Now, that's my genuine view of how it would play out, and I think that is the same scenario where the policy framework is reduced. Now, if we have a policy framework that is for avoidance, it's apparently not it, it's reduced, doesn't say that much. But and as a control activity, looking at the kinds of actions required by the minimum farming standards, I think at a very minimum, all will have to be reduced to some degree. So, through
the directness.
So, I think if one. And I'm looking at objectively, I think that's what
I'm
supposed to do.
Thank you. When you say that it doesn't say how much, there are targets, though, aren't there, for the farmer?
Targets for the collective, yes.
And just finally on that point, the difference really, isn't it, is with controlled activity, you get arguments from people saying, oh, but if you impose that condition, you're fundamentally detracting from the activity that I've applied for, which you can't do under a controlled activity.
So I've tried to include reserve matters that give the council the ability to impose requirements of what is included in a farm plan, which goes to issues of input controls and anti-claims for those and implementation of that farm plan. So that's what I anticipate.
All right.
Because what's applied for is not is important to say these are not proposed future activities, these are existing farming enterprises in the catchment, and the rules are structured as what you're talking about is farming and associated self-use infrastructure. So it's the entire activity that's at risk, not sort of an input within it.
So with policy 16, why would you therefore have terminology that says produce, which you say is a key component of that policy, but instead of at the end of that paragraph to say to assist with, why wouldn't you have something to say to ensure that you achieve the short-term 18-year goal, to ensure that there is the protection of values in the ecosystem, to ensure that there's the avoidance of fair balance, rather than assist with, it appears to me that it's a tempering of the intention of the reduction or tempering of that paragraph.
I appreciate that there was quite a long discussion through mediation that arrived at that language. So I take your point, and I think the way it will be applied will be that individual applications of consent to be judged against this. So I think this is appropriate in the way that particular application will be seen as a system with, because an individual won't be able to itself ensure that. I agree with you.
That comes back to a little bit of discretion then, because you're looking at individual's application, doesn't it? And I'll come back to you about that a bit later on, I think, and you'll come with another to finish. But I just thought I'd ask that question now while it was fresh in my head.
Thank you.
Sorry,
John. No, that's fine. Now, Objective 5, Ms. Mark, Ms. KK, and this is in the JWS. JWS Act, Question 6, on page 8. That in relation to the objective, in relation to the objective for the based on the evidence, Ms. Maher considers that the objective should include the words, including the hydrological drivers of the transport and deposition of those contaminants, because that issue is so fundamental to how contaminants are deposited within the Whangarei wetland. Do you have an issue with that?
Well, I just look at what Plan Change 1 purposes, which is in relation to all contaminants of concern, seek reductions and improvements to farming practice. So this objective, if we include those words, we should be looking for something in the framework that gives effect to that. And I don't see that, and I don't see that was the intended purpose. But I agree that those factors are relevant, but I think they're as relevant as considerations, as part of the existing environment that bears on the combination of factors that creates risk and degradation. So I don't support it being in the objective, but I think there are words in a policy in a considerations sense.
Yes, there are. I think it's 16, but in any event, that's the same answer Mr. Travolco gave me in terms of to the effect that you shouldn't include an objective in a plan if you haven't got methods or rules in order to fulfil that objective. Now, as I put to him, that's not my reading of Section 32. We should have objectives in the plan that conform with the high-level policy documents, and then whether it's this plan change or the next one, we look at the how to achieve those objectives and the costs and benefits of how to achieve them. So are you in the same school of thought that if we don't have rules or methods in this plan, then we don't include the objective?
I'm of the mind that including those things here intentionally broadens the scope of what the entire package of PC1 is trying to achieve for farming should be. If that is part of the issue statement for plan change 2, and I don't understand it to be, then it should, you know, it should be addressed. But I think it, in the context of PC1, it's going to a different issue.
Right, so is that more a legal type scope argument? A couple of more topics. The first is policy 7, and that relates to term of consent granted under this plan change. And in the beef and lamb version, so it's generally not granted where there's consent for all grass farming, etc., for a duration of more than 15 years, and in all cases not later than 2040, with generally shorter terms of subsequent plan change approaches. Now, so just to clarify, is the words "in all cases no later than 2040 intended to override the word "generally"?
Yes, it does that time.
Yes. And so you've, in your evidence in chief, done a lot of analysis on this. And we have the tension, don't we, between providing investment certainty versus the fact that we know that there's a lot of work being done on the NPSFM plan change, including ascertaining ecosystem health states for the tributaries. There'll be further work done on wetlands. I've mentioned it numerous times, the work that needs to be done on lakes. And that work will at some time be fed in to whatever approach we have in the future to farm environment plans, won't it? So, if we look at when the freshwater plan change will start influencing the process, there's a potential that the council may use a permitted activity role like in this plan change, so that it's not until the freshwater plan change becomes operative that that plan change starts to influence the process.
That's right. For permitted activities, interestingly, if this policy is granted, it would influence them. Yes.
And that's the concern, isn't it? So, do you think that policy 4.1 of the NPSFM here is relevant? But where it talks,
I usually carry it with me everywhere, but I don't actually have it with me today. I'm not joking, this is a regular feature of my briefcase, and I don't have it in front of me. So you're going to get it in front of me.
That's fine. Well, part four is timing and transitionals.
Yes.
And 4.11 says every local authority must give effect to this NPS as soon as reasonably practicable. And when I spoke Mr. Travolco and Mr. Sinclair, I think it was, about this 15 years, they said that they had calculated on the basis that the farmers were consented under this plan change. They wouldn't need to consent them under the 2024 plan change. They would be able to wait for the plan change after that. Did you hear that evidence?
I don't recall it in terms of the plan change after that. It would depend on their expiry date as to which policy provisions apply.
Yes. That sort of approach, though, usurps the implementation of the NPSFM 2020, doesn't it?
Again, it depends on what the expiry date is for these consents, because the freshwater planning instrument will have immediate legal effect on public notifications on 1st January 2025. So, applications for consent for renewals after that time will have to be assessed in terms of the proposed freshwater plan instrument, what it will wait to assess at that time.
Mm. So
not waiting until the next
Yes, so the objection to policies may have some weight, regardless of whether the council uses a PA role like it has planned to ensure that it doesn't actually fight until it's made operative. And it will be the general weighting exercise. But it's the biters that will really count, won't it, in terms of the implementation of the rules. And the 15 years is going to be a long time to wait for those that have been consented. Ms. Maris considers 10 years is more appropriate.
Yes. I've put 15 years and an outside time of 2030. I thought that was reasonable. And a framework that I'm proposing is an interesting consideration for, in this particular circumstance where we've got a freshwater planning instrument that will come across the top of things quite soon. If one takes an approach where everything needs consent, control activities, that creates a light.
Mm.
Now, and the rules of the freshwater planning instrument don't bite until the time that consent comes up for review. And I don't see that as particularly favourable in terms of giving effect to the NPSFM. I think that the approach that I've adopted is preferable than those two. So in the regime that I'm proposing, firstly there would be a more confined pool of consents, and I'm still satisfied with the 15 years and the 2040 because of the time frames, so maximum is this kind of latitude period, interim period, maximum 5 years before people are required to apply for, that's not obtained, apply for consents and change one. But I don't think that times should run from there. I think that we should acknowledge that they've got business as usual period of time for operating, and they need to be alert to what's coming. So I just want to see 2040 in those terms as being too restrictive, but I think it's always going to be realistic.
The higher risk ones will make sense, though, won't they?
Yes, that's right.
Then, do you consider it might be a good idea to have a lesser term of consent for farms and catchments where water bodies can undergo change that's very difficult to reverse, such as in lakes and wetland catchments, and this also relates to the evidence of Mr. Clee, that there are some lakes in the Waikato that haven't flipped or moved into a turbid algal dominated state. And for those lakes, we need to start reducing the nutrient inputs into them as soon as possible so they don't go into that state. And 2040 may be too long to wait. Have you turned your mind to whether in those catchments, and wetlands are the same, although there's a problem that they haven't been identified, but say for lakes, we could consider a shorter term for farms in those catchments?
Well, I think the idea of consenting is that the task for the decision maker is do I grant consent? And for some of those, as you say, the higher risk, it would be a discretionary or discretionary framework to go in. So the first question is, do I grant consent, and if or not, and if so, on what terms? So I think it goes to what conditions are applied as well. So there's always the consideration of conditions, debt, risk, and duration. So those are the new considerations that I thought were really captured by the whole body of the policy framework. But I agree they're very important, but then if it's not explicit throughout the framework and needs to be put in a duration condition, well, that I think I'd support that. But I probably want to have a look and see if this is covered already.
Yes. Well, Fish and Game's position is it's not covered already because there are no short and inadequate long-term states for lakes. that, and that's something that has to be done in 2024. Just finally then, if you can go to Ms. Maher's Appendix 1, I want to talk about signals for the future. And first of all, if I can take you to 3190361. If you have that there, if you look under table 3.11-1, Ms. Nas recommended some words there in blue to say, these target attribute states do not necessarily meet the requirements of or give effect to the NPSSM. They are currently subject to review and may be changed as part of a freshwater plan change required to give effect to the NPSSM. Additional target attribute states and nutrient outcomes are required. And target attribute states for nitrate, ammonium, phosphorus and chlorophyll A will be reviewed and updated. Do you have an issue with providing that information up front there?
I don't have an issue as such. I think it simply reports the reality. That is, it's not the only part of the reality that council has to do the work that needs to be completed to create the freshwater plan instrument. So I just have a view that it's not necessary to say that if that's the reality. But if it gives people comfort and does no harm, then I don't know that it changes the reality of what the regional council has to undertake.
Possibly not, but I did ask a couple of pharmacists a question about whether if there's going to be a change like that, whether they would want to know. And a person reading the plan might not know that. Like a pharmacist.
If it wasn't stated here.
Yes.
I'm not offended by the words that are here. I think there's a bigger issue. And in preparing for this hearing, I think that it needs to do so and the decision. And recall the work that I have been part of the collaborative stakeholder group. And it's very clear that the approach is sage and there is more to be done. And it would have to be a very large rock that one had been under to not appreciate that there is more to be done and probably quite significant and some very important discussions to be had about where those reductions are to be made in the future. So I acknowledge the desire, and I think I'm comfortable with that, but I think there's a wider reality that I'd be surprised if people aren't aware.
Thank you. Now, if I can take you back to page 319.0347. And this is my final question. Under Schedule B, which sets out currently the two avenues, the nitrogen leaching loss rate and the nitrogen risk scorecard, you will see there that Ms. Maher suggested some words in blue that these methods are proxies. They don't accurately reflect the actual risk of the discharge of four contaminants entering water. They don't account for all contaminants or all pathways and are intended to be short-term proxies to be used as a raw gateway only and until they are replaced by a more accurate methodology as part of a freshwater plan change. That's also a statement of fact, isn't it?
Yes.
And so, do you see any problem with including that there?
No, not particularly. That's the position.
Thank you very much, Ms. Foster.
Thank you. known as Foster.
Yeah.
Specifically, I want to talk to you about CBP, obviously, as the representative for Horticulture New Zealand. And you were here for Dr. Crystal's evidence yesterday, and you heard that her evidence was that if the commercial vegetable production freshwater farm plans addressed slope and inherent risks, then those concerns would be addressed by nature of the freshwater farm plan regulations.
I think there's a requirement that they produce fresh farm plans, change one. That's the extent of my thinking about it,
yes.
I have to say.
And you heard evidence that her concerns with inherent risks being climate, slope, biophysical factors are addressed through freshwater farm plans.
Yes, that's the teaching.
Given that, and in the joint witness statement for planning, you said that you thought commercial vegetable production rules would benefit from standards to address contaminants or concern for CBP. Given the requirement that commercial vegetable production must comply, have a farm environment plan in conformance with the freshwater farm plans, and that the technical evidence is that the freshwater farm plans addresses inherent risks, do you still maintain the view that minimum standards are required for commercial vegetable production?
Beyond the limit of my instant knowledge of commercial vegetable production, but what I would say is that I have not undertaken a comparison of standards one might apply and the extent to which contaminants are concerned and risks are actually addressed. So I heard the answer yesterday, but for me that is not enough of an exercise to go through to determine whether the EVPs do the job correctly. So in principle, I think that's the exercise that we've been required to satisfy myself about that. I haven't done it, but there was a view expressed today, and I agreed that that minimum farming standards, whether those are, because I don't think they're particularly expressed in the schedules for farm plans that might apply to CBP at the moment, and principle that this should be so.
Okay. Are you aware of good agricultural practice in terms of commercial vegetable production?
I had some exposure through, particularly through the Horizons 1 plan, discussions of various codes of practice and the outputs of the conference and describing what good and best management practice are. Beyond that, I don't know what it means to appeal to that.
Notwithstanding that it's different with what it means on the land, but are you aware that horticulturalists, growers, are required to or have standards in place for good agricultural practice to be able to sell in supermarkets?
I wasn't sure whether those standards or guidelines, the GATT,
yes.
Using the GATT system, whether those are standards, the extent to which those are standards or guidelines, I genuinely don't know.
So there is a general requirement for access to supermarkets, and this is in the standards evidence, that a GATT certification is generally required to be able to have access to those markets. So were you aware of that?
Yeah.
And that a grower's ability to sell in supermarkets is dependent on them having that GATT certification. And that those GATT certifications require independent audits against recognised standards. And those standards include
where I, that's the extent of my knowledge. I don't know the extent to which they address the same issues of concern, for example, under this system of a plan change by freshwater outcomes. I don't know.
Are you aware of the environmental management system add-on to NZGAP? So the environmental management system add-on aligns core GAP standards with New Zealand regulation, being food safety, environmental management systems, farm systems, that sort of thing. So you're not aware that the environmental management system aligns with the GAP standards?
Well, we've proven that we need to have a look at it and examine that before I get an answer.
So the evidence, have you read the evidence of Mr. Barber for Horticulture New Zealand?
Yes.
And so in his evidence, Mr. Barber says that the NMS, or environmental management system, requires growers to identify and make progress towards best management and good management practices.
I see that.
I might just take you to Mr. Barber's evidence. That's right, and so this is Common Bundle for 315-0013.
That seems to be
315-0013.
It seems to be a page from Ms. Hines.
Okay, and so if we just go to the start of his paragraph 39, Mr. Barber sets out that the risk assessments or scorecards are a practice that's well established within NZGAP's farm environment plans and goes through the process that growers use. So on the next page, that's 315-0013, there's the table there for the FEP process for each management area. And the relevant guidelines in that figure that are available under the NZGAP process are erosion and sediment control guidelines, practice nutrient management, vegetable crops, fertilizer association, code of practice nutrient management, discharges, mahina kai, all those matters. So with all of those guidelines in place, do you think that it would be a fair assessment that New Zealand GAP requirements with the EMS add-on address a lot of the concerns in the for smoke and climate issues?
I couldn't say that. I've read parts of these in other contexts, for example, the Fertilizer Association Trade Practice for Nutrient Management 2000, that's still 2013, aspects of that. But I couldn't draw that conclusion without going through the exercise of analysing whether they do to whether it would apply to achieve what's expected through
But you accept that?
I accept that they could be seen as means of compliance for certain purposes.
But you accept that there's already quite a level outside of Plan Change 1 of requirements for growers to be able to sell in markets.
Yes, which I think, and I don't know what that particularly relates to what those requirements are. That's what I can
say. Okay. So moving to Plan Change 1 itself, commercial vegetable production EPPs must conform with Schedule D2, correct?
Yes, need a consent for a D2 EPP.
And so the D2 farm environment plans must be certified in accordance with Part 9 of ASVA freshwater standards. And as part of the rules, the standards there, the EPPs must provide evidence to demonstrate that the discharge risks are as low as practical. 311.4.5 condition 4, and then in 311.4.8 condition 2. And provide the EPPs must also provide evidence to demonstrate that the Horticulture New Zealand Code of Practice for Nutrient Management is used. Oh, that's in 311.4.5 condition 6. As a matter of control. Oh, I got the wrong reference there, sorry. So both rules require that the discharge risks are as low as practical. And so if we just look at the controlled activity rules, so 311.4.5, the EPP must provide evidence to demonstrate that the diffuse discharge risks are as low as practical,
yes,
or will be reduced, yes. And then Roman numeral 3 there, evidence to demonstrate the Horticulture New Zealand Code of Practice for Nutrient Management is used.
Yes, it does.
And then if we flip over to the matters of control, for that control activity rule, the council reserves control over the procedures for reviewing, amending and reapproving farm environment plans.
Yes. And will be consultant and administration as well.
Yes. And if those same requirements are there for the discretionary activity rule as well.
4.8?
Yes, 4.8. Yes. And demonstrate that it's, the discharges are as low as practical or will be reduced. And if you don't comply with the farm environment requirements, you then become a non-complying activity rule if you're a commercial vegetable grower.
I was being a bit confused about what the default is for non-compliance there.
So if I take you to Rule 311.4.9, so that says at 1, any change in the use of land to commercial vegetable production that either itself or in combination with any extent, its resource consent is not regulated by 311.4.8 and does not meet the conditions of 311.4.5 and does not meet the conditions of 311.4.8 is a non-complying law. Yes, but if so if your existing commercial vegetable fraction is under 4.5,
so additional to that, so 4.8,
so either regulated under 4.5, 4.8, or
both.
Yes, that's right. And so with the requirement that you must have a farm environment plan that meets Schedule D2, including the freshwater regulations, and then the other requirements on growers to meet food safety standards and their code of practice to be able to get access to market, do you still maintain the view that you need minimum standards? Is that on top of that? In the joint witness statement, it was in relation to the controlled activity, and so that was it.
Existing?
Yes, existing.
I think that, to probably answer your question, I would need to look at it in more detail, to be fair. And I haven't done that when answering the question of the January 6th year criticism, but I think the proper exercise would be to do that.
Okay, thank you.
I mean, I just had some questions following on from some of the questions you've already been asked earlier this morning by my friend Mr. Jemiah Zongli in relation to some of the issues that arise out of Schedule C and questions of stock exclusion and fencing, which you're now familiar with, and I'll try not to unduly retraverse well-trodden ground, but I just want to get some clarification around some issues. And perhaps if I could just start with the issue that we've talked about, which you've already talked about, which is the question of averaging. Now, when I looked at your brief of evidence, and I'm referring here to your discussion of Schedule C, Condition 2, which is at paragraphs 194 and 195 of your brief of evidence, which is 307.0431 and 0432. You've referred there to the evidence of Mr. McGibbon for Federated Farmers, highlighting issues of practicality in relation to the fencing of water bodies, in brackets, but the sinuous nature of water bodies and the difficulty and cost of installing bends or corners and fences, and the need to drop straight lines to keep wires taut. And you said that you don't think Condition 2 adequately considers or accounts for that, and the answer is not, in your opinion, simply lines simply set aside a wider setback over all because this result in an inefficient use of agricultural land. So this is where you introduced here in paragraph 195 the reference to an average of 3 metres of a minimum of 1 metre. And I think when I then go and look at your Schedule 3 on page 8491, where you've reflected that change to the Schedule 2 provision attached to your brief of evidence, you've got the marginal comment there, again noting the evidence of fire witnesses about difficulties of fence in sinuous water bodies. So the issue at that stage, at least, that you were, when you were grappling with averaging, and I can kind of understand this, is the issue of water bodies that wind and having to build winding fences if you were going to follow the precise 3 metre setback requirement. That's correct, isn't it? And obviously, it seems then in the revised Schedule 3 that this notion of averaging is kind of it's been kind of grasped and perhaps extended in its application somewhat to deal with impracticability more generally as a kind of counter. That's
well, that's always separately in the framework that I proposed to Schedule C, or was Schedule C had proposed, the general impracticability exception.
So where was that? Sorry, just so that I'm unclear.
If you look, it's in the 1B2.
One B two of Schedule C.
Of
your version of Schedule C. One B Roman two grazing except for the farm one thing.
Right.
But no reference to averaging there, sorry.
No.
That's the point.
That's
sorry, I was meaning the averaging point seems to have extended out. Yes. Right. So but in any event, on the issue of averaging as it's kind of now being proposed, I suppose there are two matters. You'd accept, you've noted in answer to questions today that when we're looking at...
Just going back to that, the averaging is in 2, in my version, 2B, just started confusing me.
Sorry, 2, so paragraph 2.
Yes, clause 2.
Yes. Yes, and that's the marginal comment. Yes,
that's right.
Yeah, about sinuous water. The
practicability exception
from Schedule 2 is 1B2. Sorry, I'm just going to reread that because I had not read that 1B2 is a practicability. There's no reference to practicability in there. So,
it was at that time not. It was that other measures in the farm plan would achieve those outcomes. That's right.
Yes. Yeah. And so those are kind of other mitigations or other ways of buffering, etc. That might not be fencing. Yeah. That's right. No, so again, and in fact, if you go down to 1C, perhaps on your version. Where measurement of slope's not practicable there's talk about a gateway, that's a practicability, but I do believe there was something else in relation to buffering that had been added in elsewhere that I remember seeing that did have a practicality to it. But when we're dealing with the issue of fencing practicability issue, I suppose I just wanted to come back to that point of whether averaging is really has any utility there, or whether we're going back to the point that I think you acknowledged from yesterday that I've made about ensuring that if we're stepping by reasons of practicability inside the 3 metres, that it's for the shortest duration possible to get around whatever that practical impediment is, and then we're resuming with the standard. And so the average doesn't really come into that, does it?
Already said that aligns 100% with an idea that I put to the Beacon New Zealand team, and I think that would work. And it would limit it as well, precise as I think. The team ag approach is the averaging, and I think that could be good work, but I have thought about that as an idea as well. And I think that
when we look at that issue of practicability, and you've already had a discussion with some questions from my friends regarding that, about possible criteria that would be of value, whether expressly within the rule or as an advice note. Do you agree that we do need to perhaps distinguish fairly when we're dealing with issues of practicability to those physical challenges that the topography or the nature of the existing fence lines, etc., might create, and differentiate those from issues of cost, whether it's or supply of materials or labour shortage, because those matters can be quite subjective on a farm by farm basis in terms of whether a cost is prohibitive or expensive. For example, when obviously issues of supply of materials or labour shortages wax and wane over time. Do you agree that those things are kind of, we should grapple with those in different ways?
Yes, and I think the first, the terrain based, and it might be configuration of other things, flexibility, that goes to ability to do it at all, and the second goes to time.
Yes, so when we're looking at that time frame thing, because I think some of us acknowledge that there are some challenges in that respect for a range of those reasons, and we've talked about pricing, we've talked about the ability of getting people that are available to do that fencing within the relevant time frame. So we've got a proposal, haven't we, in Schedule C, paragraph 4, to general extension from 2 to 5 years in terms of permitted activities. That's right. And then we've also got, I think it's currently proposed by perhaps Team Ag, as you phrased it, for those controlled activities, there's that ability when you can't meet those Schedule 3 requirements to do things over a period of up to 10 years. That's correct, isn't it? Yeah.
And so, reserve
for that, as I understand. Yeah, that's right. Reserved for control by the Regional Council. And so you'd reasonably expect that those kind of matters of reserve control would look to a kind of a staged plan for when you'd be trying to exclude stock from those identified water bodies over that period of time, and this is a condition of the control activities. That would be a reasonable approach. Now, I just had another issue, and again, I'm hoping you can enlighten me as I try to work through Schedule C, and I did this to some extent with Mr. Wilson. I'm not sure if you were here for at that time. You may have read the transcript, or but I've been trying to, certainly from a lawyer's point of view, work my way through Schedule 3, both in its original form and as now.
Was it originally called Schedule 3?
What's that?
Was it originally called Schedule
3? No. The equivalent. So Schedule C anyway, and it's is now in its Team Ag form, as we call it that, and also the stock exclusion regulations. And what really struck me, and I'm not sure your perspective from a panel, but certainly mine from a lawyer, is that it's quite a challenging and meandering path that one needs to work through to really understand, and I'm not sure I entirely understand what applies and quite when. And would you agree that from a planning perspective, clarity and certainty in relation to these obligations is really important?
Yes, it's not clear which parts are additional to the stock exclusion regulations as it stands at the moment. As I said earlier, I have gone through my exercise to try and get to the bottom of that. I think I have. And I have wanted to sort of try and portray and illustrate that on different slopes, so that's pretty hard to do it.
Yes. And I think
it is.
And I think we obviously, everybody is accepting that the stock exclusion regulations apply. As a baseline, and they have their obligations, and while one can take a step in further in terms of imposing more exacting standards, one can't step back from or resile from them, as the law currently stands, can one? That's true, yeah. And so where we're providing for exceptions within this, they can't be exceptions that themselves are inconsistent with the stock exclusion regulations.
Do you have a small window of stock type and slope to which they apply this regime?
The exceptions, yes. And it's just, I suppose, my take when reading this is the exceptions seem to take up most of the thing and became almost the focus rather than what are the fundamental rules that apply and what are the exceptions to. Would that be a fair observation?
Yes.
Yes, and I'll come back to you on that point because that's what I thought I'd worked out as well, and I was getting a little bit perplexed. Now, we obviously are in a scenario, as you understand, where, well, we've got these national standards or regulations that to be quite minor, prevails over them to the extent that it imposes a higher standard, and PC1, therefore, to the extent it's giving effect to that, can do the same thing. You understand that, yes. And while not wanting to delve into the worlds of politics, we often refer to cross-reference to things such as unless otherwise provided in a set of regulations, because those regulations might change, and I think the assumption we made they might provide a more exacting standard, and we shouldn't obviously lose sight of that, but obviously there's always a bit of a risk that they might go the other way for whatever reason. That's a prospect, isn't it? Always.
Always.
Yes. And the stock exclusion regulations as they are currently in place, and to the best of your knowledge and understanding, they've been framed based on environmental issues and science and full analysis about what's appropriate and necessary.
Yes.
As a bottom line. So if we've got those and accept that that's the fundamental, if we incorporated those and made it clear what those obligations are, rather than trying to, in a couple of places, cross-reference to them, and then we could be much clearer about what our exceptions are applying to.
Thoughtful exercise, I agree.
Because one of the things, and it's going back to that point about intensive grazing, is when I looked at, for example, Clause 5 of Schedule C, which talks about the water bodies from which cattle, horses, deer and pigs must be excluded. And obviously we've got the three provisions there. We've got firstly, given them intermittently flowing waterways that are intensively grazed. And then we've got low slope land, and then we've got high slope land, if we call it that, land greater than 10 degrees. And obviously we've shifted the, we're using the 10 degrees rather than 5, so we're giving more exacting provision there. But to the extent that we're talking about that land that's not low slope land, and we're talking about beef and deer, then we haven't got any provision of stock exclusion.
No.
Regulations, no. Right.
I mean, there are texts with that.
Yes, that's right. And in terms of the intensity, that's the intensive grazing, as that's defined, which I think is...
That's what it says here. It's not actually defined. It's in one of the regulations that speak intensity grazing. So it's not actually a definition. So it's a potentially just a little bit, sloppy. So it's as described or something in the regulations.
Well, no, I think... Sorry, Jim. I think just to be clear, yes, there's reference to, and I think you're referring to Regulations 12, beef cattle, intensively grazing on any terrain, and then 13, deer intensively grazing on any terrain, and then in fact there's a definition of intensive grazing in regulation 4, which says it means break feeding or grazing on any forage crops or grazing on pasture that has been irrigated with water in the previous 12 months. So that applies for beef cattle and for deer. But when we've got this in 5A, talking about intensive grazing, cattle, horses, deer, and pigs must be excluded here from all waterways where there's intensive grazing, and then you've got this differentiation between the two slopes of terrain. When we're talking about intensive grazing in here, we're only talking expressly about, in the regulations, about beef and deer. Now, somebody might say that pigs and dairy cattle and dairy support cattle are only ever intensively grazed, but in fact, if they aren't always intensively grazed for a period, then they do get caught with the other provisions, because the exclusion is for those three stock on all terrain. That's right. And again, this is the lack of kind of clarity about the way in which we've taken bits and not taken other bits through. And I think that covers it. Thank you, sir. Thank you.
Except for perhaps very small farms. I think I've seen that somewhere in the world.
Yes.
Correct?
Yes.
All right. And then Ms. Tumai put this report to you, which you probably haven't seen and I haven't seen previously, but I have to say it did give me cause for concern when you read some of the issues that it raises around FEPs being overly focused on processes. Critical decisions being devolved to farmers and their advisors. And that was a matter I indicated to you earlier that I'd come back to you on. But it does seem to me, at least for that process, that there was a great deal which is left to farmers to provide in the FEPs. Is it your view that with this PC1 process, that extent of, flexibility won't be made available to them, or won't be as available to them, there'll be more oversight?
Yes, I can't speak, I can't really compare the length situation here. I don't know exactly what the situation is, but besides, I think that the certification that's required by Pen Change 1 and the fact that the rigour and the expectations of certifiers lies entirely with is up to the regional council. They can control that, they appoint these people, so they can, if you like, influence what standards they want to see in particular issues they put in the EPPs. I think that gives me some confidence, yes.
Yeah, I mean, in answer to this, you talked about the rigour that was required to record it, but then that comes back to the availability of certifiers, I'm assuming, and I'm unsure about the extent to which there are certifiers currently or in the process of being trained to do that particular work. Do you have anything to reassure us about those issues?
No, I agree the answers to Clark's game to those questions. I don't know more than that.
Hmm. All right. And I think there was a suggestion that there needed to be some regional knowledge which would be of assistance to those particular certifiers, wouldn't it?
Yes, but I think the certification process, the appointment process is such that you get appointed certified to certify. It
But there's nothing in BC1 which identifies the extent of that rigor as it currently is drafted, is it?
No, that is not.
So that's a matter completely for council tonight?
Yes, it is.
All right. And just in a question from Ms. Olney, talk again around the executive fees. I think there was some resistance to identifying a time frame for the MPs to be developed or provided, and I think you indicated that somewhere it might have been in policy 4 that there were, you talked about there being an intention expressed in there. I suppose my concern is intention. I intend to go home straight after these hearings, but I normally end up going to a pub first because it's a dealer. The question becomes, intention is one thing, but the issue is, where is the ability to monitor that and polish with that intention?
And in response to, I said that the provisions would be improved by making it clear in the Schedule D1, for example, specifications, that one has to itemise and prioritise the particularly for stock exclusion, what actions have been taken. So it's a difference, not he's saying I don't think that the intention of the policy should be followed through, it's just how it's done, and I think it should be done by itemising, prioritising, and enforcing to that, rather than saying everything should be done within 80 years. I just don't see that achieves the acting on priorities in a way that's intended by the policy.
So you don't see that having a benchmark, the time frame benchmark, might be of some assistance. It's been my experience, particularly in sports analogies, that having a benchmark sets a focus for matters to be completed by or aimed at, so that there's no slippage.
I guess I hadn't envisaged that people would be using farm plans, building into a great long time frames.
Mm.
So.
But it's possible.
Oh, it's possible, yeah.
And what I'd be trying to avoid is leaving open the option or that possibility and ensuring that we tighten the framework rather than leaving open the option for flexibility.
Yes. Although, what I would say is there are timeframes built in there now for stock exclusion, defence stock exclusion requirements.
Mm.
So, leaving aside exactly how long it is, but those are the end, so it's not 8 years, it's further than that. And there are timeframes built in for addressing things like races and gateways and troughs that are contributing particular standards for those. There's a timeframe for those. But most others are immediate. They have
right.
to happen. They have to be implemented now. So that'll be a question of enforcement.
Right.
And I say that the council's in a better position than ever, possibly, because it's got a statement of what I intend to do on the ground, and you can go and take an enforcement step. So I think in those terms, I see the 8th year as being
developed. Okay. My final question relates to paragraph 210 of your interest in chief. Here you're talking about Schedule D1 party, and I think you supporting Mr. Trevelco's solution of a requirement for a review of MPs where there's a 5% change in land use. So the question for me is, at what point do you suggest that there should be a requirement to review at what percentage land use change?
I haven't got a figure, but I've heard you listed that 5% describes perhaps, but if that's the fortunes of farming, it describes the band around that annually. So, I mean, I'm open to a limit, but I think it has to be informed by whatever is a material increase to that shifting band and incorporating the rolling average. I think that's the most, particularly for dry stock, which is less steady state.
Yeah.
So 5% I view is what comes down, might lose a few down a hole somewhere, so it just needs to be set at a material level, and I don't have
the number
to give you. I know what question to ask the people to get the number, which is probably the
same. All right, thank you.
around this field for 40 years. I can give you a few years on that, starting with the Bay of Plenty catchment controls in Lake Warriora. So it's an area I'm reasonably familiar with. And one of the things that I've learned over the years is that clarity and certainty of plan provisions are essential. And simple is beautiful. Do you have a view on that?
That could be achieved. Our lives
would
be a lot simpler.
Well, one of the things that does concern me is this definition of critical source areas. I know I've raised it before, but I was a little bit concerned that there seemed to be some suggestion that we should just alter what's there at the moment. To me, simple is that what you're trying to achieve. And the clear message that I've received is that it's where the animals accumulate and where there are obvious areas of animal loss. So why don't we just say that and possibly come back to a reference to the WRC document, which struck me as being a very good document. It may not cover every single aspect, but it would give certainty on most animals, and maybe the odd one too that gets missed. So I just would like your views on whether you think that kind of approach would provide a better approach than trying to alter a definition that was only part of what was intended in the regulations.
Yes, I think there's some attraction. I think the key to it is that the definition has to be capable of implementation in the field by the people who are going to implement. That's the key to me. And when I looked at the definition, particularly the addition that Dr. Crystal supports, this is an additional paragraph C, it's not worded in the way that I would normally expect the definitions in planning worded, but I'm sure that farmers and farmers understand that planning. So out of all of that, whatever the definition is, it has practical meaning, it captures all of the areas and the regulations definition, as was highlighted yesterday. Why not?
Yeah, well, I think the fact that Mr. Donnell is concerned about this suggests that it's not clear to farmers. And so I just hope that people will look at those kind of issues when we get a document back that addresses that. Another issue, I don't know whether you've heard my rantings over the last little while about things that I'm interested in, but one of them is managing expectations. And particularly in terms of achieving the attribute targets in 10 years' time for things like nitrogen, when it's going to take 5 to 10 years before the change has occurred coming through the groundwater. Do you have a view on that?
Yes, I do. I think this is now, and then this is the future, what is the new staged approach that's being adopted. And part of the expectations is that things do have to change on farm. So there's that aspect of it in as well. And that will get one part of the way, and there is more to do. Yes, I think that expectation is clear in all the background, but then I've been looking at it closely, it might not be so clear to others.
My concern is there's an expectation that the target attribute states in 10 years' time for nitrogen will be met. I don't see a way that can practically be achieved, given the fact that any reduction in the farms can take up to 15 years to get to the waterway. So is there any way that you can see that we can try and help people to understand that it is going to take a little bit longer in some cases? Probably an impossible question.
Yes. I think work needs to be done in translating the effort made on farm into what is actually, and if it can't be associated with the punitive, missing targets, there will be a massive hole that farmers can't find a way of demonstrating connection between what we're doing and some improvement, even if it's not meeting. Because there may be other confounding factors that you highlighted that mean that the throughput is diluted by something else that's been in the system for a while. But that will influence people's willingness to do more of the same in the future. And it is an important feature of it. there are some hard questions to be asked within the community about where the reductions are going to come to achieve the 80 year, what the strategy is for that, because in that sense the 10 year, what we've achieved by then or not achieving, has to be seen in that light as well. So for whatever reason occurs, those big questions are still going to have to be discussed, not in 10 years time, but between now and then. And to a large extent, I don't think those are regional questions. I think those are national. But if we are squeezing as much as we can do out of the sector on the ground, and it's at a plateauing at its limit of benefit for water quality, then there are bigger changes afoot. And I just have a view that it would be disappointing if the demands of the future post 10 years are mitigated farm by farm in the future, within the absence of a community wide discussion about where the best benefit is in catchment scale and how resources are formed to achieve that. So it's a big answer to it.
Perhaps the 2024 plan change will answer all our questions.
I'm sure those are the aspirations.
Please don't get it wrong here. I think the PC1 is going to make a lot of difference for the reasons that you said and others have said that change will occur. And just one last question really relating to ensuring that happens. Concerns have been raised about providing certainty of when fencing will occur, the flexibility to deal with unforeseen or difficult circumstances on a farm. Do you have any problem from a planning point of view with a way of expressing that by without being too fixed on the dates or the times when they say that fencing of certain areas should be undertaken as soon as practical and as far as possible within 2 years and in all cases within 5? Does that work from a planning perspective to provide some kind of certainty?
Subject to seeing how that plays out in terms of time frames for particular fencing types that get captured there. But I'm mindful of Dr. Christmas' evidence, which is fencing might be on some farms the silver bullet for them at the sediment, but it might actually be something else.
I'm just thinking of that kind of approach for fencing where it's appropriate.
Where it is agreed that it is the priority. And that goes to my comment before, that it could be more explicit than the requirements for farm plans, that those are itemised. Again, I think maybe there should be a catch-all, allowing people to itemise and prioritise within the time frame, with an overriding limit on that. But it should be tailored still.
Thank you very much. Thank you. I just want to ask you about activity status and about whether or not perhaps the expectations that people may have historically had around what activity status may mean in terms of outcomes needs to be revisited in light of the point which you've just made to Commissioner Hodges about asking the question where will the reductions actually come from. There's been a bit of debate about using non-complying status for the catch-all rule at the end, and even in your own evidence, your views about the scheme of the rule structure and about what appropriate activity status may be in between. And you were also asked by Ms. Ongley about the question of whether people would challenge a condition on a controlled activity consent, which includes obviously both land use and discharge, and suggesting that a restrictive condition could be said to be one which negates the grant of the consent and therefore could be an unlawful condition. And it seems to me that there are significant chances, high degrees of likelihood, that at all levels of the consenting structure, reductions will need to be imposed on such things as stocking, imported feed, other measures to control nitrogen loss or other contaminant loss. And if that's right, to what extent does the regularity of the activity statuses in the rule structure make much difference? To what extent is there a big difference here between restricted discretionary, and non-compliant?
Goes to the advice it turns on, really. And that's going to be its farm expertise, I think. I can't see someone like a reporting officer contradicting that advice. So it's going to be a contest between farm experts, I think, in those circumstances, regardless of activity status.
But the rule of thumb that, from my vantage point, seems to be adopted by processing officers and consent authorities, that restricted discretionary will be granted, and discretionary will likely be granted, and non-complying will start with turning it down and then negotiate. That'll have to be revisited, won't it?
Yes, it should be revisited anyway. I observe exactly the same.
Right.
But that's correct. And also the misapprehension that a full discretionary activity is more restrictive than a restricted discretionary activity, because it's not.
Well, given the requirement in both cases, given the nature of the matters for which discretion has notionally been restricted in PC1, I've got to say to you, from a legal point of view, I'm not sure there's a great deal of difference between restricted discretionary and discretionary in these rules. Can you say that that's incorrect?
Well, I think the difference is that the last reserved discretionary matter on the list is the extent to which the policies of this chapter
apply,
and for discretionary is just a bit.
Oh, okay, so it'll be.
So only to that extent. And the clarification, I think, is some of the New Zealand Federal Funds relating to non compliance instead of the considerations applied to the extent of non compliance.
Yes, well, and issues then of proportionality and practicability, if you want to use that word in the whole thing. Perhaps as the last witness called by Ethan Lamb, I'll take this opportunity. Throughout the plan change, there's a reference to farmed cattle, horses, deer, and pigs. How many feral cattle, horses, deer, and pigs are there in the catchment that we should take into account?
Well, I'd love the job of going out counting them, but I'd if this was a different region.
Well, I understand that, and I wonder whether or not that's where it came from. But it did seem to me that, and the small gains are to be treasured. Getting rid of words that are unnecessary is something that we can still pursue. Thank you, Ms. Foster. Anything arising from the court's questions?
Thank you.
Sorry, so it's technically a matter arising, but I just wondered if it might assist Commissioner Hodges in particular to draw to the court's attention the explanatory note to the table, which is found on pages 52 and 53 of the consolidated version. That might alleviate some of Commissioner Hodges' concerns with the time lag issue. So I don't think that page in particular has been discussed.
Yeah, it's not so much my expectations I'm worried about, it's other people's. Because it would be awful if everyone was doing absolutely the right thing, but it's not monitored exactly as people expect when they say this is fair. Because I don't think it will fail, I think it can move people forward.
Well, hopefully the expansion might make it easy.
Thank you.
I think I'm supposed to be rescued. Well, we take the luncheon.
I was just about to say, Your Honour, that completes our case for Kenro Farms and Beacon Lamb.
Thank you.
And just in terms of my own Section 32 analysis, in terms of efficiency, If I may seek leave to be excused, the rest of the team will be present, and I'll be back again on the 6th.
Leaves come and go, as Francis will order.
Thank you.
Now, I just want to know if everyone is still reasonably confident that the case for Wairaki Pastoral can be completed this afternoon. Anyone saying otherwise? Ms. Ongley, you
have very few questions.
Right, okay. Well, you're sitting together, I mean.
No, I just clearly
know
over that.
Yeah. All right, so everyone is of that view that we should be able to complete this afternoon. Thank you very much.
Yes.
Very good. All right. A 2:15 start then still acceptable. 2:15, everyone. Thank you.
Thank you.